Here we are in the Congressional Corner with Representative Antonio Delgado of New York's 19th District. Congressman, it's wonderful to speak with you again.
Thank you.
Do you think separating the roads and bridges bill from the human infrastructure bill is the right way to go in all of this?
Well, it's the way that we're proceeding. You know, we have a bipartisan agreement, and working in principle, with the details are still being, focused on and worked out. I mean, at this very moment, there actually isn't any real bill text yet for both the bipartisan agreement that was reached in principle, but also the larger $3.5 trillion bill framework. So not one of those have been given any proper or bill text yet. So the fact is, though, I've long talked about the need to where we can do it. We need to make sure we can work on a bipartisan basis. So if we have a situation where the parties can come together, as they have, at least in principle, around surface transportation with roads and with bridges and with broadband, then we need to push forward on that. And we need to make sure that we treat that, for what it is. And then separate and apart from that, if there's other ongoing negotiations around a larger package, then we can engage in those as well. But I think it's important that we look at these things for what they are and as standalones. And so if we're able to get some progress here and get real text, then we should be able to proceed moving forward. That would be my preferred approach.
It has not escaped us that the Republicans are basically the party of no. So I suspect that they're worried about Trump and what he does to them and the rest. Even now, there's some last-minute thinking about that bipartisan agreement as to whether it's worth it or not, from their perspective.
Well, I mean, I think, you're right. There's a dynamic that is happening around whether or not the language that ultimately gets in the bill, what it'll be. I think there's a I'd rather not, to be honest with you. I don't talk about, what one party thinks versus another party thinks. I think if we're in a position where we actually have a chance to get a bipartisan agreement done, then that's still to be determined, right? I mean, you're hearing folks who are saying, well, we can't vote on anything until we have bill text. Well, that's not an irrational point of view, right? I mean, now, it's not that we haven't done that in the past, though. There have been scenarios where, the kind of votes that are being proposed have been taken prior to there actually being a text included. But it's not irrational, to suggest that, on a bill of this magnitude with so much importance and all the stakes, that before you actually cast a vote in any way, shape, or form, you want to know the text. You want to know what the pay-fors might be. Right. And so I think before we just start, jumping ship here and start pointing fingers and saying, oh, you don't really want to do this, or you're just a party of no. Well, why don't we first let the process unfold and see actually what can come out before we just jump to conclusions? Because I think that's part of the problem right now, is that there's a tendency to sort of short circuit these processes in a way that ultimately becomes a self-fulfilling prophecy.
Well, I certainly understand what you're saying. On the other hand, there is a bit of history here, Congressman, in which the Republicans just do continue to say no, and, you can hardly ignore it.
Well, listen, there's no doubt that, there has been a pattern and practice of obstruction that one has to be mindful of and account for when at every instance when you sit down to negotiate, right? I mean, you're not negotiating in a vacuum. You're not going into every situation unaware of what preceded it. And there's no doubt been a pattern and practice of obstruction that certainly should color the ways in which we engage and do so in a way where part of this process is to continue to test whether or not we actually have good faith actors at the table. Right. And so you have to balance out that history with the desire ultimately to get something done, and not just get something done from the standpoint of, the understanding that we have real needs, which we have to meet, but also I think getting something done, particularly if we can do so on a bipartisan basis, that reassures the American people that we're not as dysfunctional as one might think here in Washington, that we can come together, that we can figure out a way to find common ground. And I think that's important, too, because it speaks to the larger sense of confidence people have in the institution of Congress, which then speaks to the larger issue of people's faith in this thing we call democracy, which to me is very, very important when we're thinking about how to put all of this in its proper context.
You know, a great deal is being said about voting rights. The House has a voting bill, which seems very sensible to me. The Republicans obviously don't like it. You got to get it through the Senate, which many people think it can't be done. Are you amazed that people will really try to win elections by going to state legislatures and saying, fix it so only we, in this case the Republicans, can win?
There's no doubt I'm very, very concerned, deeply concerned and disturbed by some of the trend lines here. When you think about the amount of laws that have passed since Shelby v. Holder, where the Section 5 of the Voting Rights Act was gutted by the Supreme Court, you know, we think there's been about 25 states that have enacted, you know, bills that, you know, make it more difficult to cast a vote. And there's been near 100, you know, bills that have been introduced across the country, you know, this year alone that have meant to make it more challenging. And the thing that I try to, you know, get my mind wrapped around is what the motivation is. What's driving these bills? The argument oftentimes is, well, it's to push back against voter fraud. But the fact of the matter is there's no basis whatsoever for that claim. There's just been no evidentiary basis. There's no data. It is entirely divorced from what's actually the case. And so once you remove the fact that voter fraud isn't indeed happening, not nearly at any degree that warrants the type of pushback we're experiencing through this legislation, then the question becomes, well, then what is the real motivation, right? What is the real objective? And I think that's where it gets concerning because, you know, we should never be in a position where we're taking anti-democratic stances. We're making it more difficult, particularly when we're not even being faced with any real legitimate claims of voter fraud. If there's no claim, no legitimate claim, then we really can't be taking this type of position because then it's just purely anti-democratic. It is purely an assault on this essential right to vote. You know, and I've been very supportive of H.R. 1. I have legislation, my CLEAR Act bill, that's in part of H.R. 1. I know that there are folks in the Senate, you know, folks like Manchin, who've expressed that there's, you know, a lot in the bill and maybe, you know, we can whittle it down a bit. And I believe he's even proposed a number of items within the bill that he'd be okay with. I think, you know, again, we need to think about what we can get done, right? Sometimes you can't get everything done in one fell swoop. But if there's room to get something done, then we need to get it done because we see what's happening on the other side in terms of making it more and more difficult. And it's really inexcusable. It really is inexcusable. And it's incumbent upon those of us who are fierce advocates of democracy to stand up and do what's right.
So Congressman, the IRS needs resources in order to collect the taxes that we know they should be collecting. And there's some real opposition from the Republicans on that. What do you make of that?
Right. This goes back to the question earlier about the pay-fors, you know, for any potential infrastructure bill. And we know that, you know, when you think about even going back to the corporate rate, you know, you look at the average rate that's being paid, it's still significantly lower than what they're actually obligated to pay by law. Right. If the rate is 21%, but we're still, you know, in some cases, companies are not paying anything, you know, or single digits. And so the question becomes why? And how is that the case? And how do we account for that disparity? What if we just had a system where we had enough resources in place to ensure that what you are obligated to pay under the law of the land, you pay it? It's that simple. You know, if the law of the land dictates you pay this percent. If you're not paying that percent, then that's a problem. And so making sure that we have the resources to ensure that people are abiding by the law, to make sure that we there in turn have the revenue, you know, that we can then utilize collectively as a country to figure out what we want to invest in, whether that is infrastructure, which, by the way, when you invest in infrastructure, you get a return on that investment, right? We're giving these breaks away to these big companies, these big corporations, but where's the money actually going? Is it being put back into the pockets of the American people? Is it creating better wages? Is it creating more jobs? Or is it being used to buy back stocks?
Representative.
So I think that's part of the problem.
Representative Antonio Delgado is of New York's beautiful 19th district. Congressman Delgado, always wonderful to talk to you. Thank you.
Sounds good.